All right, this is the case of Eric John Blair versus Jackie Sue Anderson. The file number is 820-0691. I want to welcome you to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The appellant will have 15 minutes, followed by the respondent with 15 minutes of oral argument. The appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please introduce yourself prior to beginning your oral arguments and let us know who you represent. With that being said, the appellant may proceed at this time.
May it please the court and counsel, good morning, honorable members of the appellate court. I'm Tom Jensen here for the defendant appellant, and appreciate the opportunity to present these arguments to the court today. It's a small case, but it's a case that has significant issues that I think are important to the injury trial bar and really the larger trial bar. In our state, when we deal with these issues of prejudgment interest and costs and disbursements. And so I wanted to take you through how the case really ended. That is, at the time of the post-trial motions before His Honor, Judge Churchwell. And I'll start by a few comments about the issue of additor. What happened here is that there was a zero award for general damages, as your honors are aware. These verdicts can be upheld in the appeals court and often are. Here, the honorable district judge ruled in favor of additor, finding that the jury did not give conscientious consideration to the evidence in reaching its award. And there was no evidence or no indication that prejudice was present or anything else that would ordinarily justify a court in taking away a verdict of no general damages in a personal injury action. At that point, we were faced with a prospect of accepting it or going to a new trial on damages. And the reality is that retrying damages while the pre-verdict interest statute is running, and then appealing to determine whether or not the trial judge's original decision on additor was appropriate or not appropriate as a matter of law, is a very difficult situation for an appellant to be in. And so my only plea on this point, obviously I'm not contesting the additor, is that if you're ever appointed to an ivory tower committee on appellate procedure and additor, those old decisions on additor that place an appellant in a box where a trial judge says, I don't think the jury worked hard enough, I'm gonna award $15,000, requires, I think, a relook. That aside, as I continue to review honorable-
Counsel, can I turn your attention to the letter of January 26, 2017?
Yes, Your Honor.
What else does the statute require in this letter for it to constitute a notice of claim?
Well, here, respectfully, Your Honor, I would go right to this court's decision in the Trapp case, which reflected the term written demand that was argued in the briefs, but also, as Your Honor will know, a series of federal court judges Susan Richard Nelson, Eric Tostrew, John Thunheim, Richard Kyle, Minnesota judges involving probably Minnesota educated law clerks, found that it requires something more than, hi, I'm Tom Jensen, personal injury attorney. Please give me some file information.
Well, I mean, to be fair, counsel, I mean, if you look at the letter itself, which is what we need to do to figure out if it is a written notice of claim. I mean, this is a case where there's a death involved, that there's already a claim that has been a claim file that's been opened, that there's some discovery that has been done. And now there's a well-known personal injury law firm that has been retained on behalf of a client. So isn't that enough information for the insurer to be placed on notice that there is a claim and that the insurer can from that information determine its potential liability?
No, respectfully, Your Honor. There's no indication whatsoever in this letter of the nature of the injury sustained that would value a personal injury claim, as Your Honor is well knows. And if we look at the federal court views of this very issue, and Your Honor, Judge Giannis's issue, there has to be something that gives the insurer a sense that, okay, we have these injuries, we have a feeling for this liability, we have a left turn in front of an oncoming motor vehicle, we have this policy limit, we should maybe set this reserve within the insurance company so that we have a sense, okay,
why is that the responsibility of the claimant?
Because they're seeking prejudgment interest and they have full control, Your Honor, over the situation.
So I want to go back to the statute then, because 54909 provides for the commencement of the clock starts ticking for prejudgment interest upon submission of a written notice of claim or a demand for arbitration. That's another situation when prejudgment interest begins. But the legislature didn't use the word demand when it's referring to a notice of claim. So why is it that there has to be some sort of a demand associated with a notice from counsel seeking to discover the basis of coverage?
Respectfully, Your Honor, and I think I would have to point out that the word demand is not in the statute. We all know.
It is. Yes, it is.
Or a demand for arbitration.
Yes, it is. 54909 subdivision 1B. From the time of the commencement of the action or a demand for arbitration or the time of a written notice of claim. I'm reading it off of the reviser's website right now.
Well, if I may, Your Honor, the statute previously required a settlement demand. That was taken out in 1991, and notice of claim was interposed. So the question is this, really. I'm making an argument in favor of something between the letter of introduction that we have here and a settlement demand that the legislature took out of that statute. And it's really a Goldilocks position. Something in between where there's some indication of the nature of the claim so that the insurance company can evaluate the situation, know what the injuries are, maybe learn something about wage loss, or if the person cannot work, something, so that the insurance company can set a reserve. One doesn't set a reserve based on the January 27th letter. And so,
well, don't they have, I mean, they know how much insurance is applicable, right? I mean, isn't it the whole reason you give a notice of claim so you can figure out what the insurance limits are? So you know what you're working with?
Well, respectfully, not at all, Your Honor. And certainly that's the argument that they're making. They say all the insurance company has to know is its policy limit. It receives a letter that says, I'm the lawyer. Will you give us some information? And then they know what to do. Well, you have to have some sense, respectfully, Your Honor, what the nature of the claim is. You have to have a sense for what the liability, you know, facts are. And so to simply say that a counsel introduction or request for information letter amounts to something that should trigger the insurance company to evaluate liability, evaluate damages, set a reserve that doesn't require a full-out settlement demand, but something.
But isn't the date of the accident, the identity of the insured, the identity of the injured person, the fact that there were injuries sustained, and the knowledge that you have an entire file with color copies of any property damage photographs, accident scene photographs, repair estimates, and statements concerning the loss, isn't that enough to place your client on notice that something happened here and the insurance company is involved and there's some coverage limits and there are attorneys and there's somebody who's making a claim now.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, you're assuming that in fact that the insurance company had these things in the file. There's no evidence that the insurance company had these things in the file. The plaintiff's attorney is simply saying, give us the information that you have. This is the first letter involved in the case. No one knows what was in Chris O'Hagan's file. And really, in the end, you're either on a position where an introduction letter and a request for information is a notice of claim, and all five or six federal judges just are wrong. And certainly I respect that you have that prerogative, and I'm sure guarded jealously. But at the same time, that's not a notice of claim.
So let me ask you a different question. Is it your claim that 54909 subdivision 1B is ambiguous?
Well, that's a good question, Your Honor. And I note that Her Honor Judge Janisch, when she issued the decision in Starring Lake that you have before you, ruled that in fact it was not ambiguous, and that it is obvious that it means something more than what the respondent and so far the panel seems to think. So I think I would have to support Her Honor on that ruling at the point. Again, it's just a matter of fundamental fairness. They're going to get prejudgment interest at some point along the line if they get a successful verdict. They can make a settlement demand. They can give us some information about the nature of the claim they might or might not present. Well,
can I ask you this? Do you think that it has to be a settlement demand before the prejudgment interest starts?
No, I don't, Judge, because again, that term was taken out in 1991 by the legislature. So the question is, well, is it this letter or is it something more that provides insight into the nature of the injuries, the nature of the damages, which this emphatically does not do?
All right. Is this a matter of first impression for our panel?
Yeah, I think it is. Now, when we look at that, I think it was the Trapp decision that talked about a written demand. I quoted it in the briefs. But I think it is. Obviously, I scoured every case I could find on this, and it's just the federal judges that have been talking about it. But I think I have to say that it is. If somebody would say that this court's comment about written demand in that Trapp case, I think it was, is its, view of the world on this. And I'm not sure about that.
So coupling my previous question with what Judge Hooten is asking, what is it in the statute, or what is the only reasonable interpretation of the language in the statute which leads you to the conclusion that something more has to be in there? And then what is that something more, and what's the legal basis for that something more?
Here on this question, Your Honor, respectfully, I'd like to rely on the respondent's argument. Because here, the honorable respondent has told the court that Black's Law Dictionary defines a claim as the assertion of an existing right. I ask the panel to consider, where is the assertion of an existing right in the January letter? The respondent argues, notice, according to some law, the American Heritage Dictionary, notice means the condition of being formally warned or notify. Well, again, that is not what we have here in the January 27 letter. And then what the respondent says, and please parse these sentences, they say on page 16 of their brief that Eric Blair's notice of claim announced and warned Anderson's insurer of his existing right to payment of his damages resulting from the crash. That's what they told you. And that emphatically is not in this letter. So again, it has to be something like Her Honor suggested. in starring Lake or the five or six federal judges, that you have to give the insurance, you know, to claim prejudgment interest on damages money, you have to give them something that shows what that's going to be based upon. And they have not done so. I keep repeating myself, but it's very obvious. And studying of those decisions by honorable judges, it's just obvious that you know, the appellant's position is right here. I'm a little concerned I'm running out of time on the issues relating to, obviously, the prejudgment interest statute. If I may just shift, do we have a clock here? Sorry, I'm a little new to this on the web.
There is supposed to be a clock on the screen.
Okay, and
I think your time has expired. But
okay. Right. Well, thank you very much. I'll look forward to stepping back.
All right, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you very much, Your Honor.
The respondent may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court and counsel. I'm Matt Barber for the respondent, Eric Blair. I'm going to start with the notice issue that the court has focused most of its oral argument on here. The statute 54909 subdivision 1B does not require anything more than what is in this letter. The legislature expressly removed the term settlement demand and replaced it with notice of claim. Notice is a low bar here, and we quoted what notice means. Same thing with a notice of claim, same thing with what claim means. The existing right here is a negligence claim. The right existed at the time of the crash, and this letter was sent roughly 6 months after the crash. So what we asked this insurance adjuster to do was, let's step back. As the court mentioned, this is a letter from a personal injury law firm to a claims representative, Mr. O'Hagan, and it's sent to the company called Land of Lakes Claims Services, Inc. It is a claim services. When they get letters, these are notices of claims that are accruing to their insureds. So in the Ray line, it explains that the personal injury law firm has a client, Mr. Blair. It identifies who the insurance company's insured is, Patrick Anderson. It lets them know that there is an accident, the date of the accident, and which liability insurance policy number, which liability insurance policy is at issue by number. And this is a farming policy. So the insurance company is on notice that this is an accident falling under the purview of its farm policy. And the damages that are being sought are injury damages resulting from the accident that's dated above. In addition, not only does the plaintiff ask the insurance company for the amount of coverage, it asks the claims person to open a claim and give us a claim number. That's notice of the nature of the claim. It's a negligence claim. It's personal injury damages arising from an accident.
That's not entirely fair, counsel. It doesn't ask the insurance company to open a claim.
I suppose that could be an inference, Your Honor, but it does ask to have a claim number provided to us. It's the middle paragraph in the body.
I see it. Provide us with your claim number. My question to you is, when I read this letter, it looks to me like you're making inquiries about what's in their file. It doesn't look to me as though you're saying, I've got a claim and buckle up. It doesn't say that to me. And typically these letters do at the very top say notice of claim.
It could say notice in it, but it uses the word claim all throughout. It says, please provide us your claim number. It is a letter from a personal injury law firm about a negligence claim to an insurance claim adjuster. So the notice is there when the context is considered. This court should consider the context of what this letter is. It's a letter from a personal injury law firm to an insurance claims person, letting the claims person know that there is a claim that relates to this accident on this date for injury damages for Mr. Blair. So that is letting, under the context of this letter, it's letting the claims person know there is a claim. Please provide us with a claim number. The inference is there is a claim here and you need to open a claims file with a claims number. And then the last paragraph is asking for what is in any claims file that may already exist, because again, this letter was sent roughly 6 months after the date of the crash. So an inference could be made that the insurance claims person already has a file open relating to this accident, and we're asking for some information about the known claim that the insurance company has. As far as the language of the statute goes, it does not require anything more than this. The legislature took out settlement demand, so there's no need to demand a specific amount from it. But as the court pointed out, we did identify the policy number, so the insurance policy limit is what liability the insurance company can expect to have on this claim that they've been notified of.
Counsel, are you in agreement that the language of 549.091B is unambiguous?
We are, Your Honor, yes. Appellant points to the Trapp case, and the Trapp case actually does not address this issue, so this is an issue of first impression. Trapp looks at whether interest commenced from the commencement of the action, so when the summons and complaint was served, or from the date the claim arose, the date of the accident, and that was under the common law. Here we're looking at what does the statute provide for, so Trapp is an opposite. Unless the court has any other questions on the notice issue, I can move on to a different issue.
Well, can I just ask you, I mean, I think you've kind of addressed it, but I want to hit it head on. And that, if I heard Mr. Jensen correctly, he's just saying the way this was written, it looked like an introduction, and it looked like you wanted that the attorneys wanted information. And he said, there's nothing in there that says we are making a claim for damages and on behalf of the client. And he said, at a minimum, that should have been in there. I mean, he's conceding that you don't need to have a explicit settlement demand, but I think if I had to paraphrase what he said, he's going, if you're giving me a notice of claim, or you're giving my client a notice of claim, make it a notice of claim. Say I am claiming damages, and that letter doesn't say that, and therefore it shouldn't be considered a notice of claim. How do you respond to that?
Right. So we've got two paragraphs and the inferences drawn from them, plus the context of this letter. So with the context being personal injury law firm sending a letter to a claims representative. And then the first paragraph says that the personal injury law firm has been retained to represent the person who's been identified as the injured person in connection with his injuries for the accident. So that lets the claims person know who's seasoned in this type of this area of business and law, that there is a claim here and these attorneys represent that person for that claim. And then the next paragraph we've talked about, it's confirm your coverage and provide us with a claim number. So it lets them know that this is and we have the policy number identified there. So this is an action under this policy, and let us know what it is. And the inference is open a claims file and give us a number assigned to that claim. So it might not be, in print, but it's in between the lines, and between a personal injury attorney and a claims person, it's clear that we've got a claim. We're letting them know about the claim, and we'd like to get working on the claim, because the last paragraph says, if you have any information about it, please give it to us so we can start getting this claim resolved and working it up and getting it to a settlement or a trial or however we're going to dispose of this case. Unless the court has any other questions about the notice, I can move on to one of the other three issues. If the court has a preference, I'd be happy to jump to whatever issue that is.
You may proceed, whatever you think is most important.
I'll jump to the interest on the additor, the general damages. The appellant talked about additor and the nature of additor at the very beginning. Clark is an additor case. It cites two of the most prominent additor cases from our Minnesota Supreme Court. It cites Levine, and it cites Seidel. And it explains that additor is appropriate where the verdict is inadequate. And Clark's facts are materially similar to ours. There, the plaintiff proved special damages. So in a personal injury case, the medical expenses and general damages, the pain and suffering that are commensurate with the medical expenses that were incurred for the injuries he sustained. And the court explained in Clark that where the jury awards only special damages and the plaintiff has proved general damages, either additor or a new trial on damages is appropriate. And it relies on Levine and Seidel for that proposition. And the appellant here accepted the additor in this case. And what the additor here is it's general damages. And under the pre-verdict interest statute, general damages receive pre-verdict interest. So all we're asking is that once this verdict became complete by virtue of the additor, general past damages receive pre-verdict interest, and that's what should be awarded here. Unless the
is this also an issue of first impression?
I believe it is. I haven't seen a published decision from Minnesota's appellate courts on interest for additor of past general damages, but it's an application of pre-verdict interest to general damages and the settled law in Clark about additor when special damages are proved and so are general damages and the jury only awards special damages. So it's not a big extension for this court. It's just applying, it's basically 2 + 2 = 4 for this court. Unless the court has any other questions, I won't need to address anything and we would respectfully ask that the trial court be affirmed in all respects.
Counsel, I do have one question about the Rule 68. In your brief, you seem to suggest that if anything is remanded, that issue ought to go back to the district court.
Correct, Your Honor. So our Rule 68
that position.
Yes. So we made a Rule 68 total obligation offer for, I believe it was $90,000. And after everything was all said and done after the post-trial motions, we beat our Rule 68 offer of judgment. So we were entitled to Rule 68 costs as well. If this court modifies the district court's decision in such a way that we no longer beat our Rule 68 offer, then the district court would have to go back and remove those costs.
That's your point in saying it should go back to the district court, only if somehow the dollar amount then changes significantly enough to not meet the threshold for Rule 68.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Unless the court has any other questions, I feel like everything's been fully briefed and we would ask that the trial court be affirmed.
Okay. Could I ask you, with regard to the two police officers that testified, they were not called as experts in the case. Am I correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. And the Johnson versus Southern Minnesota Machinery case that we cite to in our brief explains that the depositions do not need to be used at trial in order for the district court to properly exercise its discretion to award the costs.
But why were they paid more than the amounts that you would ordinarily pay lay witnesses if they were not called as experts?
I believe it's the cost is for their deposition transcript. So it's paying the court reporter for taking their deposition testimony, if that's correct. Otherwise.
Well, I think they were paid witness fees, but I think they were paid like $300 a piece instead of capping it and for a lay witness.
And then Quaid at 261 explains that a non-expert witness is allowed discretionary costs based on the trial court. And in that case, it was $900 in non-expert witness costs, and ours are much lower than that per witness. So we would respectfully submit that this trial court was within his discretion to award those costs.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
Yeah, thank you very much, honorable members of the court. I do want to spend a few moments here on the question of the rate of interest. This goes to the question, does statute section 3.01 or does 549.09 apply, 10% versus 6%? It's been fully briefed. And there's just no question, again, that this court has held in Hoganson, and I think Your Honor Judge Frisch was on that Else case this summer, where I think Hoganson was applied, if I have those cases right. And the point is this, use 549.09 for, you know, general damages, not liquidated or readily ascertainable damages. Those are covered by Section 334. And so the plaintiff claims that the damages in the case are not readily ascertainable. These were medical bills and totals that were stipulated as evidence in the trial, the exact numbers. So it's disingenuous, obviously, to say that these damages were not readily ascertainable. Then, on the question of interest on additor,
can I go back to the original issue that we were discussing, counsel? Mr. Barber indicates that the context under which the letter is delivered to the insurance company is important, and the context of the letter is an important consideration in determining whether the letter constitutes a notice of claim. And when I read Judge Tostrud's opinion in Creekview, it seems that that's the conclusion that he reaches as well on page 10, looks like page 10 of the, on page 1068 of his opinion, that the only reason an insured would open a claim with an insurance carrier is it believed that a loss was covered under the policy. It claims some amount of payment from the insurer for the damage, and from the information supplied in the letter, the insurance company could have determined its potential liability. Do you agree that the context is important, or do you believe that context should not be considered in determining whether the letter is a notice of claim?
I guess I would say respectfully, Your Honor, that I don't think it should be considered. The plaintiff has every opportunity to control when prejudgment interest is to commence. Every opportunity to do, they could have done it on January 18th or whatever the date was afterward, where they at least gave some indication of the nature of the damages and so forth. And so to say that, to read into that January 2017 letter, that which is not there, if that is what context is, then I would respectfully disagree.
So your belief is that you look at just the four corners of the document and that's it?
I do. Because again, they have every opportunity to control what they want to do. There's nothing in that letter that would allow an insurance company to set a reserve on a case. It's just, hi, I'm an injury attorney, and would you send me what you have?
Thank you.
Does that mean there's going to be a claim presented? You saw my reference to priests, imams, and so forth, eyewitnesses. No, there would not be a claim presented. So I hope I've addressed that, Your Honor. If I could just say a couple words here about interest on additor, as the honorable judges have seen, it's a pre-verdict interest statute. The additor rejects that verdict, and a compound, you know, misery on injury, or whatever the cliche is. We show that under the statute, interest should not be awarded on that portion that's founded upon interest, attorney's fees, or other similar items added by the court. Well, we had a very big similar item here added by the court, and statutorily it says they don't get interest on that, respectfully, Your Honor. And then if I could just add—
But counsel, it was added to the verdict, which those
it
other—
It was added to the judgment, I would respectfully submit, Your Honor.
Well, but it was additor to the jury's verdict.
Well, I respect the question, a good question, but I would simply respectfully disagree. It was added to the judgment, I would say, Your Honor. And it's not a pre-judgment interest statute, I would also respectfully submit. In terms of the issue of costs, the expert witness fees for the rebuttal expert, you know, again, a rebuttal expert, two experts come in and they want, what is it, $8,000 or $9,000? Rule 127 says they don't get paid for preparation. And the respondent says, well, that Rule 127 contradicts statute section 357.25. The judge or any court of record can allow fees or compensation as maybe just and reasonable. That statute does not conflict with Rule 127's prohibition on preparation. Of course it In fact, courts must award costs and disbursements. But the issue here is preparation and all those things we set forth. Every photocopy is a taxable cost under Section 357, our statutes? No. You don't try cases, get to the end, and put in the attorney's costs and disbursements bill and say, here, court, we get all of these things. That's what happened here. There was no hearing, no consideration, a simple statement that said, I find them all reasonable. It just isn't fair. I'm only looking for a modicum of fairness here on this appeal, on a post-trial order where everything seemed to be go wrong. And that's why I bothered you here with this. But these issues are good, it's obvious we need, the trial bar, and I respectfully submit the trial judges need a few friendly reminders here on what should happen in post-trial motions when mediation has taken out so many of these appeals and, you know, people are wandering in the woods. So,
can I ask you about the payment to the police officers? Okay. Because you argued that they should have not received the $300 and they should have received only the $20 for regular witness fees. But then on oral argument, citing Quaid, the respondent says that's a discretionary call by the judge. And unless it's an abuse of discretion, that we should affirm it. How do you respond?
Well, because the law distinguishes between what experts should receive and what fact witnesses should receive. And it's undisputed here that the police officers were fact witnesses. I was asked earlier to Mr. Barber, they were fact witnesses. And so when the law creates a separate structure and expert is chosen for fact witnesses, I don't think that's an abuse of discretion. I think that's just getting the statutory law wrong. And so hopefully I've adequately responded to Your Honor's question. Okay. Well, thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for hearing me out. It's been my pleasure to appear before all of you, and best wishes to you and Mr. Barber for a nice day.
All right. Thank you very much. And thank you, counsel, for your very well done briefs and oral arguments. We will take the matter under advisement. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Your Honors. Mm-hmm.